So then, I have fallen in love.
Aww.
It is not often that something captures my heart in the same way. It has been years since the modern ad nauseum days. Near have my heart been so attached. Orzhov Pixie feels so good right now.
Ben, have you played this deck?
No, I haven't played Orzhov
Pixie. Did you know this deck existed?
I did know it existed, yes.
Ha.
Highest win rate deck at the Pro Tour.
Bias. There was one player who had an 88%.
What was that player's name?
Ben Stark?
What's Ben Stark's list of accomplishments?
A very, very little known Magic player. Very new, first time. Actually, their first time playing was at the Pro Tour. They got the wild card entry.
For those who may not know, Ben Stark is a Hall of Famer.
He's one of the best Magic players.
Of all time.
Of all time.
And so one of the challenges when parsing results like this is, was it the deck or the pilot?
I mean, in this instance, I think there was a little bit of both. I mean, Ben Stark is just an incredible player. And I think the deck slanted itself in a way that was very competitive. I remember I was talking, you'll find this funny, I hope. I was talking to Maya because I said to her, I was like, I am going to, like, fine. You've broken me down. You've talked about it so much. I will play Orzhov Pixie on Arena. And I did a, like, 7-game test, and I went 4-3. And I was like, this is perfectly reasonable, but isn't the level of win that I expected from this deck. And I texted this to Maya, and Maya said, really? I've won 11 straight games in a row. And I said, what are you doing? And she said, playing best of one. And I said, okay, no. I went winning
game one is a really important part of Magic.
Okay, but if you don't play the next two games, because I went 4-3 playing best of three on Arena, which is the, like, it's the paper equivalent. That's what you play in paper, is you play best of three matches with access to your sideboard. And again, 4-3 is perfectly reasonable, a little bit better than half, but not, I wasn't blown away. A lot of decks, if you are a YouTube consumer of Magic the Gathering content, there are a lot of creators out there who will talk about 70% win rate, 60% win rate, and 4-3 is around that mark. So just keep that kind of in mind when you see these, like, big statistical numbers and they're like, this deck is crazy. It's a 65% win rate. It's like, that's average, to be honest with you. And I say this, like, as a lover and a massive consumer of YouTube, like, creator content.
Yeah, there's small sample size is the problem here. Right, you know, if someone's saying, oh, I've got a 65% win rate with a deck, and if your follow-up question is, okay, how many matches have you played? And they say, like, 10. Like, well, A, that doesn't math, but B, you're like, okay, well, that's an incredibly small sample size. You could have just paired into a particular deck that is a good matchup more than the average in that 10 sample size, and that is, of course, going to bias you. If the person replies, oh, it's not my data, this archetype has, you know, 1,000 matches, or, you know, orders of magnitude larger, and it's 65% over 1,000 matches, then you listen. Then you go, okay, if at that point, if you're going 4-3 with a deck that's, you know, at that sort of statistical significance, you're like, okay, what am I doing wrong? Whereas if it's you picked up a deck and someone's won, you know, played 10 matches with it and won 7 out of 10, you're just like, but you only go 5-5 or whatever, you're like, yeah, that's perfectly within a normal distribution. So,
well, because, like, what was Domain Overlords' win rate at Pro Tour? It was, like, 56%?
Yeah, across 52 players. It was the most represented deck, and it did very, very well.
Which is not unreasonable for, I mean, like, Pro Tour is not the largest field in the world. You've got some, like, the Spotlight Series, where, like, there, where you start to get real statistical numbers. Quality of the player does matter for this. You know, if Jason Yee, for example, is winning with a deck, that means that if you're playing at a 95% level, then, yes, you might, which is how good Jason is, then yeah, that's probably where you're at. But if I pick that up and I'm like, yeah, I'm winning a little bit with this, it's a player issue, to be honest, skill issue.
Well, look, and that's exactly kind of the point I'm hoping to make as well, is that, you know, numbers only speak for so much depending on what your numbers are, because Domain Overlords was well overrepresented in the top eight of the last Pro Tour. And, you know, you can look at it and say, oh, a 56% win rate. Orzhov Pixie had an 88% win rate. And then you have to look at the number of players in the sample size, which is one player who's one of the best players of all time versus 56 players. And then you also have to think about how many games were played by those players. One player only played 24 games.
Of standard, they'll play 10 matches.
So around 30.
Potentially 10 matches, could be less, you know, if your draft didn't go too well, which I wouldn't expect for Ben Stark. But if your draft didn't go too well, you might get halfway through day two and be like, I'm out of everything, I'll drop. Or if, on the other end of the spectrum, if you did very well, you might not play the last couple of matches, because once you've qualified for the top eight, they don't make you play anymore. So I can't remember who finished first in the Swiss, but you might only play like 13 or 14 of the 16 Swiss rounds with that deck.
Yeah, so you're looking at around 30 games, you know, let's say 36 games for one player, like, and that's a best of three. Like, they're saying you're going to game three every single time, versus how many games did 56 players play altogether to still get you a 56% win rate?
I will say, I haven't had much of an opportunity to talk about why Orzhov Pixie.
We got real statistical.
Make your case right now.
It is like, it is not the most played deck. It is not the most represented deck. It is a deck played by one very good player that did relatively well and has not seen much of an uptake over the course of the rest of the standard events that I have seen. It is also a symptom of, it is a style of deck I really enjoy playing. I was playing a lot of Waste Not back in the Pioneer days. I like grindy, discard, Liliana of the Veil decks. I find them exciting, and I am very familiar with the play patterns that are associated with them. That being said, I unironically think this deck is actually very good. I think it attacks on an axis that a lot of decks aren't prepared for. It utilizes this sort of, speaking, I suppose, in slightly more like mathematical terms, I think it leverages the marginal utility of the strength of the bounce effects very, very well. I think it doesn't lean too heavily, it doesn't lean too heavily into that effect, but the amount that it has for the power of the enter the battlefield effects that are in the deck is, puts it in a really good place. And I think that its matchups across the best decks in the format are also quite good. It has, surprisingly, an excellent Overlords matchup, because it goes over the top of Overlords, which is a wild thing to say.
I think it doesn't let them get to their top as well when you start discarding their cards.
Exactly, exactly. But because you have a lot of answers for things like Up the Beanstalk, you're running Lauren to deal with the looming threats of the impending Overlords, you have a lot of ways to discard cards, and you have that repeatable card advantage that is hard to interact with in the form of Unholy Annex, it is well positioned to take advantage of the best deck in the format. It is also quite good against aggressive decks. Four copies of Temporary Lockdown is very, very strong. You have life gain in the form of Unholy Annex when you have a demon in play, because you have the Soulstone Sanctuary and the Restless Land. You have Pixie, which is a 1-mana 2-2, which blocks for days, and you do have those momentum breaker effects in the life gain element, plays well into those matchups, and the ability to attack the hand of an aggro deck in an efficient manner while also being able to commit resources to the board in the forms of Pixie and momentum breakers actually does make that matchup reasonably good. I don't think it's 70%, but I think it's like 55%.
Oh, yeah. Don't get me wrong, it's a good deck.
I think it's really good, and I think it is underplayed and underrepresented.
Okay, so you covered off two of that top three, the tier one that I identified earlier. Left one off.
Pixie matchup is about 50-50.
Okay.
Yeah. From what I can tell. Because the reason why it's 50-50 is because you do get more value when they bounce your temporary lockdowns. Mm-hmm. And it is still reasonably close. The aggressive starts are hard to deal with, especially when they have consistent answers for your temporary lockdown. But between Get Lost for Storm Chaser's talents to prevent the late game in the game combo, and the fact that you can pick and choose when you're losing and gaining life from Unholy Annex with Nurturing Pixie returning it to your hand, the matchup I have found in my remarkably small sample size of about 70 games is about 50-50.
Yeah. Look, the reason I ask this is because I'm going to comment a little on the nature of the Pro Tour field relative to your local game store, FNM style tournament. Everyone at the Pro Tour is there to win, right? Like, and obviously each individual might have a different aspiration. Some just want to make the second day. Some are really looking for that you know, top eight style finish. But no one's bringing, I don't know, merfolk to the Pro Tour. I'm sure that's a shot at someone who did, but I apologize, whoever you are.
I would say Mulch is currently on merfolk in standard.
That was the inspiration for the comment. But no, so when you get to that, like, you can theorize about the metagame and be confident that a certain subset of decks are going to be more presented than others. So you can sit down and something that my team did, it was they figured out that the best three decks in the format were the decks, which means that they're going to be the most played. Within that scissor, paper, rock dynamic, they found that one of them was behind, and so they naturally gravitated to two of those three decks. Funnily enough, two of those three decks were in the top eight, right? So what you're describing now is possibly Ben Stark and the people he worked with, which probably was Channel Fireball, but I don't know if he did work with someone for that tournament, but probably did a similar process. They sat down, they said, okay, here's what the metagame we're going to play out looks like, and Stark has had enough faith in his own abilities to say, I have a good domain matchup, I have a good aggro matchup, I don't think Pixie is going to be particularly well represented, which means that this deck is a good metagame call. And a metagame call is incredibly important. Now, you might pick up Orzhov Pixie, go to your local FNM and run into only Esper all night and be very frustrated. Or you might pick it up and go to a qualifier or a regionals and run into Domain all day long and be overjoyed with your choice. Metagame calls are a type of deck that can work out very well for you. I've had some luck with doing that in the past. I've also been on the unlucky side of perceived variance as well. In Australia, we a couple of weeks ago had our regionals for Modern, Breach being the best deck.
I was going to say that
was
breakdown,
a phenomenal good metagame call deck in that tournament.
That breakdown was insane. What was the overall percentage representation of Breach?
Yeah, it's about 25% Breach.
That's crazy.
The only matchup that has like a reasonably consistent positive win rate against the deck is like Black White Necro or something.
Primetime as well.
Yeah, Primeval Titan would be if I had the time to learn an amulet, that's what I would probably take in that. But there was a phenomenally good call. So the player who ended up winning that regionals, Tom Bott, brought an Eldrazi build, not a 7-mana Eldrazi build like you might have thought, but a deck focused around Chalice of the Void. 4 main deck Chalice of the Void. And against Breach, funnily enough, that's pretty effective. So, there was a couple of them who worked on the deck. They both top eighted of the two players. Really good choice. They absolutely nailed the metagame, and it paid off for them. They could have been unlucky. They could have paired into, I'm not sure what the worst matchups for the deck are, because it's got a little bit of traction, but it's not an established player by any stretch, and it won't be because hopefully some particular deck's getting banned soon.
Ban announcement coming soon.
But my point was more around Orzhov Pixie. Stark probably did the work, knowing Ben Stark. Probably got a pretty good sense of what the metagame might break down to and absolutely nailed that choice. Now, that metagame hasn't really shifted that far from that. And so if you're sitting down at your locals or whatever it is, if you are going to have that kind of high concentration of people playing those tier one decks, this will be a good choice. It does a couple of things I like. One, two color is easier than three. So one of the issues that my team had with the Esper deck was the mana base. Obviously, there's a lot of really good lands in standard at the moment, but three colors is always tough. So losing a color helps. I would naturally prefer, I think, to lose the white, but this is a different style of deck to that blue-black bounce variant of the Pixie deck because it is going a little bit more of that control route with things like targeted discard, temporary lockdown. Like, you are trying to control the hands of your opponents, you're trying to control the board state, and so it's kind of attacking on a slightly different axis to your point, which does mean that if the rest of the metagame doesn't have a significant player like that within its calculations, it has the potential to disrupt. That may change if it becomes a larger player in the metagame. So if you take these sorts of decks and you're actually it's attacking the metagame really well right now, and a lot of people get to that same conclusion and starts to gain metagame share, then people start putting cards in the sideboard for you. Whereas right now, it sounds like they're not. My skepticism is there for the deck. I personally haven't played it, and so I would be remiss of me to say that, you know, this deck is bad, because without any experience, you can't really ever say that. We don't have statistical significance to conclusively say one way or the other, and even then, stats lie. So will I be picking it up anytime soon? Probably not. I admittedly have to go through a bit of a phase in my personal testing process where I do need to check off all the big decks and then go and explore all the tier twos and react to how Dragons of Tarkir, or whatever it is the new set's called. Is it called Dragons?
Tarkir Dragonstorm.
Sorry. and how that reacts to shake things up. So my focus is going to be, as a self-professed competitive player, on that tier one and any movements in that space. But yeah. If this is going to disrupt that tier one, or if it's going to hit those tier one decks particularly well, then it could be a phenomenally good metagame choice. And on a good weekend, you can be rewarded for that. I would argue that that's what Calamity Combo was for me. I think that was a metagame choice. I sat down and I thought I had good matchups against a couple of the tier one decks in that format, and I got paid off for that meta call. I played it again semi-recently and ran into Pixie, and that matchup is miserable. Right? And so now I wouldn't advocate for bringing Calamity Combo, because the metagame has shifted and that metagame is now hostile to the type of thing that deck is trying to do. If the format changes, if something like Orzhov Pixie becomes the top tier deck, maybe Smuggler's Surprise and Calamity Combo comes back. So maybe I should be encouraging people to play this.
I mean, I would not be mad to play Calamity Combo. It's a very cool deck.
And I would not be mad to play more Orzhov Pixie. So let's make this happen. Let's make this happen.
We have to sit down and play against each other and play the Orzhov Pixie matchup.
We do have to put it through the gauntlet. We need to demonstrate.
Well, look, something that I actually really want to get your ear on is you've mentioned this idea of, you know, how the metagame breaks down, how to, like, metagame calls and what the metagame looks like. What is that process like, you know, from a testing team perspective? How do you predict the way that a field is going to level out? You know, Matt Nass, you know, was talking in his article about how he wanted the field to be 20% aggro and, you know, 20% other decks. And there was 18% aggro and 25% other. How is that calculation run? How do you do that from a testing perspective?
Yeah, so before every major tournament, we have a team meeting where we talk about the metagame and we go through the process and we go walk through each of the decks and say, here's what we think it'll be. So that is a dedicated slot on our agenda list for every major tournament. For us, that typically means going through recent history, and there's degrees of difficulty for this. The most recent RC, we were one of the last ones in Australia, New Zealand to occur, and so that made it much easier because you can kind of just go and look at all the other RCs. If you're all earlier on in that process, or if you're a pro tour where there is very few tournaments in the lead up, it's a much harder process. So typically things looking like Magic the Gathering Online top 8 results, looking at MTG Goldfish, recent competitive tournament series and the like. That's the bread and butter. That's the easy, low-hanging fruit. Through to the other end of that very difficult end of the spectrum, which is that the pro tour after a rotation, right? You know, a pro tour after a standard rotation sort of thing where it really could be anything. That's a very tough challenge and one that I don't think anyone ever gets right.
So this year is going to be one of those instances this year, and I think, dare I say it, it's going to be Spider-Man is the set that's out when rotation happens, because rotation is happening in August of this year. And I think that's roughly when Spider-Man is slotted to come out. So we'll have Pro Tour Spider-Man.
For those who can't see, my eyes are rolling.
So that's going to be an instance of anything goes. There's a deck that's going to potentially take us by surprise. And is there any way to plan for that? Or is that kind of just a vibes guess of, we've seen this deck do well in these two tournaments, and there is a chance that based on those two placements, people will pick this deck up?
Yeah, very real chance. I think the most recent one that we can look at in a soft rotation in a format was Pro Tour Nadu. Right, and so that was yes, it's an Eternal format, but a Modern Horizon set typically is such a significant shakeup. And so there wasn't a huge gap. I think it was 2 or 3 weeks before that.
Yep.
And there was a bunch of new decks, new archetypes, but that was enough time, that 2 or 3 weeks, for people to have a reasonably good sense of it. The team that I work with Bus Stop, we found and had Nardu ready to go. We didn't play it as much as we should. Two of, I think, the 8 or 6 of us playing that tournament in the testing house played Nardu. I played Calamity Combo, but in Modern, which was through the Breach Emrakul.
Did Brennan play Nardu?
Brennan played Nardu.
Of course he did.
Yeah. Yeah, he couldn't get Amulet to work. So.
But now he's laughing.
Yeah.
Now he's laughing. He's having the best time on Amulet Titan right now.
But yeah, my point was that there are cards that come out that are clearly mistakes and they're easy to pick up on.
Nardu was one of them.
Yeah. With a rotation, there you know that the existing decks that haven't lost, you know, core key cards are going to stick around in some form. They might mutate, they might change a color, add a color, lose a color.
Bloomburrow is not going away, so you can expect mono red to still exist.
100%.
Well, but most interestingly, right, Xur rotates this year, so Domain Overlords is going to have to change pretty significantly because you won't be able to animate the Overlords anymore in the same way or until some other similar effect comes into play. But Xur and Leyline Binding rotate this year.
When's Up the Beanstalk rotate at the same time?
No, Wilds of Eldraine. We are keeping that for another year. That'll be next year, I believe. Ban announcements notwithstanding.
I'd be shocked if they ban anything in Standard.
If we had more time, I would have loved to ask you and get more into detail. If you had to pick, just off the cuff right now, 3 problematic cards in Standard, or cards that are decent enough, prolific enough, change the pace of the game enough to warrant a banning, think a la Reflections of Kiki-Jiki, Reckoner Bankbuster, Invoke Despair. Those were the last Standard bans that we had. What cards?
Can I play the straight bat? And I don't think there are any ban-worthy cards in Standard at the moment.
No, I think that's very fair. I think that's a very fair answer. I think, and Maya and I have a discussion on this coming in a later bonus episode for just, I think the format's pretty good as it is. I don't think there is anything that is so devastatingly problematic that the format hasn't course corrected to address in some way. I would agree. I think people have been like putting their hands up and going, Beanstalk, and it's like, oh well, just get lost it, pick your poison it.
I think Standard is the most fun it's been in a really long time, and I would be very hesitant to take any action to change it beyond the normal evolution of a Standard metagame.
Someone said Monstrous Rage and I was like, oh, did someone lose to mice too many times? Like, it's a good red pump spell, but the thing that's good about it in a way is that it's devastatingly predictable.
There's a meme running around which is a stick figure wearing a scissors life, as in rock, paper, scissors life. and it's this person being like, I think rock is overpowered, rock should be banned. Rock is everything that's wrong with magic at the moment. And there's a real sense of that within particularly magic discourse around people just, they don't want to adapt. They don't want to try to defeat whatever it is that they're losing to. They don't want to put sideboard cards in. They don't want to, not take their pet card out because it's bad in the mashup, whatever it might be.
Leave my Haunt the Network alone.
I look at the metagame of Standard at the moment and I think there are clearly distinct ways you can succeed that fit into different play styles. I think there is room for innovation. I think no deck is too dominant, both in terms of metagame percentage or win rate. And that is the definition of a healthy format. You can go and look at Modern if you want to see what an unhealthy one looks like. So, I think a lot of people can be reactionary. They are devoted to a deck that is going to have a bad matchup somewhere. And because they have that one bad matchup, they continue to not try to improve it. They just yell out into the ether.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think a deck representation over 15% is probably where you'd start to say like, this is a bit overrepresented. I think the 20% is even really where I'd say there's a significant problem, because back when that Rakdos deck was running around in Standard, I think it was like a 35 or 40%.
I think it was
like 40%, and Reckoner Bankbuster had hit like a 50-something% inclusion across multiple decks. But Standard is currently like 12, 12, 15, 7, 10, 8. Whereas again, like we looked at the RC up in Sydney and it was 25% breach. And it was like, all right, maybe maybe that's something to look at.
I honestly thought it would be higher.
I did also. I thought it would be a little bit higher.
We had it lower in our prediction.
Really?
And this was a miscalculation. And this is very much off the thing. We thought people would struggle to get the cards.
And is that actually so
struggle to get mox opals and grinding stations?
Interestingly,
opals, yeah.
Is that actually something that plays into the way that you understand
we
and
we
predict?
We had a huge amount of conversation around should we be including that as a factor, and some people in the room said no, we shouldn't. Like, you know, this is, people are going to go and fork out the $1,200 for the four copies of this card or whatever it was at the time.
$180 in the bog window.
I'm literally. Maya texted me and was like, there's a playset of Mopals for $180 Australian. Do you want them? And I was like, Maya, I wish I had $180 for one Mopal.
Yeah. So we thought that there'd be, and we were kind of divided as a team over whether or not that we thought this was a factor. We talked to Pat about it. Pat has some inside information on how movement of cards around the country is moving. big game, big team advantage there. We kind of compromised where I think we put it at about 20% on the spreadsheet that we had for where it was, and it ended up being 25, which was a slight miscalculation, not obviously completely out of the realm of possibility, but I think we had, I think other was like 35% of the room or something, which was the one we also got wrong. Is that right? Anyway, doesn't matter. metagame predicting is very hard, but I can't remember how we started on this.
That's all right. I think, unfortunately, we've actually run out of time. It has hit the mid-afternoon time. But thank you so much for joining us. This has been incredibly fun, incredibly enlightening. Thank you for giving us your time. And we hope that you'll come back another time soon.
Lovely to be here. Thank you for having me.
Awesome. Thank you very much.